Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm Victoria Thorpe, sitting in for Joseph Pache and David Onick. Tonight on City Visions, we're exploring the experiences of Muslim women in the Bay Area. The Bay Area has one of the highest concentrations of Muslims of any metropolitan area in the United States, according to the Bay Area Muslim Study, recently released by Santa Clara University's Institute for Policy and Understanding. This study reports that the Bay Area's Muslim community is diverse and growing, hailing from regions across Asia, Africa, and the Middle East. However, the study's authors also noted that local Muslims are not fully woven into the fabric of Bay Area life. So tonight we'll talk about what is it like to be a Muslim woman in the Bay Area? How are Muslim women expressing themselves in their art? Is it possible to be a Muslim and a feminist? And what are the differences between media representations of Muslim women and their reality? Tonight, we'll discuss these questions and more with three Muslim women artists from the Bay Area and learn how they are challenging stereotypes, both in their art and in how they live. We have in the studio three guests. Zara Norbash is a writer, performer, and comedian whose most recent show was called All Atheists Are Muslim. A graduate of UC Berkeley, Zara has performed at the San Francisco Theater Festival, the Solo Performance Workshop Festival, and is a member of Disoriented, a trio of Asian American performers who tour the U.S. She was also a finalist in the Aspen National Rooftop College Competition Comedy Competition. Welcome, Zara.
Thank you.
Samina Ali is a novelist, writer, and artist. She recently curated an online exhibition from the San Francisco-based International Museum of Women called Muslima that presents a wide collection of thought-provoking perspectives and visually arresting artwork from contemporary Muslim women from around the world. A link to that show is available on our City Visions website. Samina's debut novel, Madras on Rainy Days, was awarded the Prix Premier Roman Étranger 2005 award in France. She is also the co-founder of Daughters of Hajar, a Muslim-American feminist organization, and is a blogger on the Huffington Post. Welcome, Samina.
Thank you for having me.
Asia Abdraman, did I get that right?
Yes, you did.
Close enough. Is an artist and entrepreneur based in Mill Valley who explores the relationship between culture, human rights, and environmental protection. She was born in what is now Ethiopia and considers herself a second-generation Muslim feminist. Asia is a featured artist in the Muslima exhibit. Welcome, Asia.
Thank you for having me.
At about 20 minutes after the hour, we will invite your listeners to join our conversation by dialing 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. Or you can email us now at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com or post a comment on KALW or on our Facebook page. So let's start our conversation tonight by hearing a little bit from each one of our guests about the experiences that you've all had confronting the stereotypes of Muslim women. I think we'll just kind of get that out there and explain to us what it's like to sit in your shoes as Muslim women and very diverse perspectives we have here at the table. So I want to hear from each one of you and give our I gave you a tiny little, you know, bit of background about each of you, but I would love to hear you explain your backgrounds and, you know, maybe tell us a story or two or just illustrate your experience as a Muslim woman in the Bay Area and how you try and navigate the worlds that you come from and where you live. I'm going to start with you, Samina, if that's okay.
Yes. You know, I've been working on Muslim women's issues for over a decade now. And it started with the novel that you mentioned, Madras on Rainy Days, and then went on to Daughters of Hajar and, you know, working with the State Department and now, you know, curating this exhibition, Muslima. And I can tell you that in all of my various roles, I've traveled throughout the U.S. and internationally. And often when people think about Muslim women, the things that come to their mind consistently are that Muslim women are victims, that they're submissive, that they're all veiled, and that they're all Arab. And, you know, you can see me, but I know that our listeners can't, but you can, I'm not Arab. I don't veil. I'm not submissive. I can, you know, talk to my husband about that. And it's something that I've been trying to counter with both my activism and with my work, and especially with the Muslima exhibition. And unfortunately, it feels like the longer we move away from 9/11, the more enforced these stereotypes of Muslim women are.
So tell us a little bit about where your family background is from, too, if you would just explain that to us.
Absolutely. I was born in India, and I was half raised in India and half in the U.S., and I've been living in the Bay Area for about 15 years now, and I guess I don't consider myself one of those Muslims who hasn't integrated mm-hmm. or assimilated into the fabric here. I very much feel very, very San Franciscan.
Okay, and that's and it's interesting to hear that although you feel integrated into Bay Area life and certainly are an assimilated person in how you see yourself, you still come up against those stereotypes in your experiences.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I was recently traveling, and every time I travel, I get stopped just because of my name. Mm-hmm. I was recently traveling with my two children, and they wouldn't let me go through, but they said, oh, but your children can go through. My son is 13, my daughter's 4, and I'm looking at, you know, the ticket agents mm-hmm. are thinking, I'm not going to be letting my children
right,
on that
right.
plane without me. That's
yes,
not
if
gonna
they're
going to
get on the plane and fly away, yeah. and they'll stay behind.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, so no matter how much you try and fit into the mainstream, and you still come up against those,
absolutely.
Those images people have in their head. And we'll come back to you, and I'm going to go to our next guest. Would you mind giving us a little bit of your background, Zara, and explaining to us how you've experienced these stereotypes?
Well, my name is Zara. I am a Muslim, feminist, Iranian-American comedian.
Many of those, right?
Yes, all of the above. And apparently two of my identities can't take a joke, so we'll see how my career pans out. I am submissive if there's a prize.
Say more about that.
Well, I like to win, and if it sounds like that's going to reach the goal, then I'm down. Otherwise, I kind of like to pave my own way. I also don't wear hijab. I describe myself as the pork eating, alcohol drinking, premarital sex having kind of Muslim. And I love saying that because then I always get, you know, people saying, oh, I'm that kind of Catholic, you know?
Right.
Stereotypes for me are such a part of my work because, for one thing, in comedy, they're the information that people come in with. Whether they believe it or they don't believe it, it's on the table, and they're waiting for me to address it somehow. And when I first began my career in comedy, I thought that, and I think this happens for a lot of comedians who are women or who are comedians of color, I thought, you know, I can leave my identity at home and be the default, just like everybody else, quote unquote. And what I started to find, actually under the tutelage of W. Kamau Bell, who had the solo performance workshop at the time, was that the default is not me. And my perspective is different, and that's allowed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's actually interesting. And that provides something that is called voice. That was this magical thing that every writer was always aiming to achieve. And for a long time, I found myself sort of battling against stereotypes and then reacting to them and then wondering what it was like when I owned them and played with that. And now I feel like I have sort of a better understanding, especially now as a woman over 30, of who I am, what my voice is, what I want to say, and that I'm allowed.
So give me an example of a stereotype that you've turned on its head that way. So it sounds like stereotypes felt to
absolutely.
You like a block, and now they're almost like your material. They're your fodder for your comedy. So can you give us an example of something that fits into that category?
The first two words of my sentence. I am a Muslim feminist comedian, you know.
Even saying that is a funny statement,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it's a stereotype that Muslims don't have a sense of humor, mm-hmm. you know. It's a stereotype that Muslims can't be feminist. It's a stereotype that feminists don't have a sense of humor. So it's a lot of fun to bring all of those three things together in my material and begin there and say, here we go.
And do you feel like you're diffusing those stereotypes through your humor?
I think so. I think with my humor, I think people kind of start to realize, oh yeah, stereotypes are kind of just that. They're just sort of this vapid, you know, overlay. Here's this real person and what that means.
Mm-hmm. And once you know somebody, it takes on a totally different meaning.
Certainly, especially in the story element of sort of connecting with a character and their experience and knowing that you can do that.
Mm-hmm. That's great. And Asya, let's turn to you, and if you would explain to us a little bit about your background and how you've experienced these stereotypes and how you continue to experience them in your life.
Well, my background is East African. I came as about 5-6 years old as a refugee. And when I came to this country with my mother and my brothers and sisters, and when we came, my mom was wearing a veil. And the very first thing that happened to her when she came here is her brother said, "Take your veil off. Because, you know, you're an American now. We don't do that here." And I grew up in San Diego, you know, the same as every other American child, you know, at the beach, you know, wonderful upbringing. And moved to the Bay Area in my around when I was about 18, 19. So at that time, I chose to put on my veil, but it was an on and off thing. I wore it when I wanted to and took it off when I didn't want to wear it. And I noticed the more I wore it, I was more comfortable, you know. So I am a Muslim, and I'm also an artist. As a Muslim, I don't drink, I don't smoke, I don't eat pork or any of that. But I don't see that that's any part of my identity. The choices that I make are my free will, my choice. When it comes to wearing my hijab or my scarf, it is because it's a thing of comfort. I noticed even as a child, I always had a hat on, you know. So I come from a series of very strong women. You know, my grandmothers were gold traders. My great-grandmothers built their own homes and built their cities. So I'm kind of following, you know, their theme of women of strength despite, you know, what they appear like. My mom, you know, saved us from genital mutilation, you know, as a child in a culture that it's, you know, it's very accepted and a woman is not pure if she's not sewed up, you know, and all that. But, you know, my mom knew it was wrong. It happened to her and she didn't like it. And so she told everyone, well, yeah, we did it in the last neighborhood, you know, we ran. So then, you know, she knew we were getting out because of the conflict. But, you know, being a Muslim and believing in your faith means also protecting yourself, even if you have to not tell something that is true, you know, to defend yourself, you know. So if women are being abused in that kind of way, then, you know, you should, instead of being saying no and having the whole community come down on you, you can be like, oh, yeah, we did.
So your mom's path was to
be defiant,
protect her own family and to be defiant, but in a quiet sort of almost invisible way. And say more about your sense of comfort with wearing your hijab. How does that feel for you when you have it off, or what's different when it's on? I think.
Well, what's different when it's off is that no one recognizes me.
You know,
that's the very first thing. It's almost as if I'm a different person. Mm-hmm. And then when I have it on, you know, it's I'm treated very differently. I do notice that. Being raised in America, I know the two different ways that when you're not covered, people don't know that you're Muslim usually. You know, they just think you're just, you know, they can't really tell what race I am usually. But when I'm covered, then it's almost kind of like I have a banner mm-hmm. and I'm going around town, you know, representing themes that everyone that wears a veil. And that's not really true. I think what you wear is, you know, each person is different.
And is it a negative perception that you feel differently when you're wearing hijab, when you feel like you are wearing that banner of I'm Muslim, you know, I'm representing this?
Well, it's kind of like being out of the closet, you know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So
it's that, you know, I am proud of who I am. I'm not ashamed of being Muslim. You know, that is a part of me. It isn't everything that I am, but it is, you know, it's a path that I'm following. You know, religions to me are kind of like, you know, the freeway. You know, you take a bunch of different roads. So the road that I'm on is Islam.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm interested for you, Samina and for Zara, since you don't wear a hijab, how does your identity come out for you? I mean, you sounds like, Zara, you put it out there in your comedy very quickly. But maybe you could just both share, you know, it sounds like your name sometimes triggers people to wonder about your background, Samina. But, you know, at what moment, maybe you could tell a story of, like, that moment of someone figuring out that you're Muslim, and maybe, you know, did they, like you said, Asya, they sort of changed how they interacted with you, either of them, you've ever experienced that.
Oh, I get a lot of, I don't know if you two have gotten this, but I get a lot of, oh, well, Zara, you're one of the good Muslims. Mm. There are some bad ones that are out there, but you're one of the good ones.
And what do you say?
Well, I find myself so conflicted by that. In fact, I actually have a podcast now with Taz Ahmed called Good Muslim, Bad Muslim, just out of this scenario, because technically amongst my community, I am a bad Muslim. I eat pork. I was promiscuous in college. I drink and don't adhere to these rules, though I identify as Muslim. The members that say this to me outside of my community, I'm a good Muslim because if you're very Muslim, then you wreak havoc, apparently, is another stereotype that really feels like someone's, it doesn't feel like as we have this as a consciousness, we have a consciousness of this as a stereotype. It feels like that's often a definition that I come up against. For me, you were asking about identity.
Identity, you know. So you know, it sounds like you put it out there very quickly in your work and in your comedy.
I think for me, what ends up coming out there with me is its complexity, mm-hmm. the confusion, the complexity, the gray area, my reclaiming of some definitions.
So maybe our listeners might be having some question in their head that I have right now. So if you say, I break all these rules, but I'm still a Muslim, you know, and you have Catholics say to you, well, I never go to church, but I'm still Catholic, or, you know,
right.
I never go to temple, but I'm still Jewish. You know, at what point are you, how far do you feel like you can push it before you are starting to kind of, is it just, it's hardwired, so
all the way to the doors of hell, baby, just before I get thrust in.
You feel like that identity as a Muslim is outside of anything in your practicing faith?
Yes, I think absolutely. There are things about the way that I've grown up, my identity, who I am, the story of my name that my father told me, that Prophet Muhammad had a baby girl and her name was Zahra Fatima, and that it meant something that the Prophet's child, his first child, his child from given to him, blessed by God, was a baby girl. You know, all these stories, you know, a lot of the folklore, my spirituality, my sense of spirituality of Allah as, you know, not personified, not a person, not a man, not a woman, and that to think Allah is such as offensive, that it is in everything and everywhere that you are. I can't separate myself from those beliefs. Those will always be a part of me.
So it sounds like that distinction between your faith and maybe the practices that you are expected to follow through to put that faith into action are, you know, you have the faith inside of you and you have your beliefs inside of you.
There seems to be, from my vantage point, it feels like there are, outside of the Muslim community, sort of different rules put on the religion of Islam. Like, most religion doesn't make sense, right? I mean, most religion, you know, we believe in it, and faith is a big part of that. Mm-hmm. Logic is not. It's something you connect with. It's something that sort of chooses you and sort of helps you lay down a path toward a life that you want to lead. And that's what I'm doing, and that's what religion serves to do. Mm-hmm. And so, I get to do that.
Yes, and hold on to your faith in a way that works for you. I'm going to turn to Samina in just a moment. I just want to take a minute and remind everyone we're listening to City Visions Radio on KALW 91.7 in San Francisco. And tonight we're talking with three Muslim women artists and hearing their perspectives. We have Zora Norbash, a comedian, writer, and performer whose most recent show was All Atheists Are Muslim. Samina Ali, a novelist and curator of the online exhibit Muslima, Muslim Women's Arts and Voices. And Azia Abdraman, a featured artist in the Muslima exhibit. We'd love to have you hear from you, our listeners, with your questions or comments. If you are also Muslim and you want to weigh in on your experiences, or if you have questions for our guests, the number to call to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or you can email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com or post a comment on KALW.org or on our Facebook page. So, Samina, we were just talking about for you as an assimilated American, and how do you communicate your faith to people, and how does that come up for you?
You know, I think one of the most important things that I want to get across is that there is no one Muslim, and there are so many different Muslim communities and so many different Muslims. And even in the United States itself, you know, we were, when you introduced all of us, you were talking about how the concentration of Muslims in San Francisco Bay Area is one of the largest. And all of these Muslims are coming from very different parts of the world. So what happens is everyone brings their own culture. And the cultural expression of Islam is very different depending on where you go in the world. For instance, in India, my parents have been there for generations. My family has been there for generations. And they've been Muslim for generations. But the way they practice Islam is very assimilated into Hinduism and into Indian culture. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, when a woman gets married, a Muslim woman gets married in India. When I got married in India, I wore a traditional Indian Hindu dress. So it was red. And I had all of the gold jewelry and the pearls and, you know, and I had a 5-day long wedding and, you know, I had all of these amazing things happening. But that's not part of Islam. That's just part of my culture of being Indian. Mm-hmm. The Islamic way of having a wedding is it's just a nikah. It's, you know, the bride wears white, and it's a very contained one-day event. It's certainly not a 5-day long festival. So when I think about myself in the U.S., now having grown, you know, emigrated to the U.S., have lived largely in the U.S., it doesn't feel very different to me. If my parents in India can be, you know, be Muslim with a very Hindu cultural, you know, expression of their faith, I feel like I can be here with a very American cultural expression of my faith. And we don't veil. We're Muslim, but we don't veil. And so, and that also, it depends on a woman's opinion, whether she wants, you know, it depends on her faith. It depends on, there's so many different reasons why different women choose to veil. It's so deeply personal. So it's, for me, even though I don't veil, even though I may not come across to someone who's walking down the street as, oh, there goes a Muslim woman. You know, obviously, when you're walking down the street, you can't say, oh, there goes a Jewish woman. Mm-hmm. Oh, there goes a Christian woman. I mean, faith is very internal. And the unfortunate thing about Islam is that it's become so deeply problematic, especially within media and the images that we see constantly, that it's become externalized. And so Muslims have to constantly battle against what they're seeing on TV, what people are saying about them, and their own very deeply personal, deeply internal interpretation of their own faith.
Mm-hmm. You have to find some middle ground, so you're figuring a way through that. And I'm interested, because you brought this up, is that wonder if either one of you, your families are from Iran and your family's from East Africa, if that whole kind of cultural piece and faith piece kind of comes in some contrast, like Samina just mentioned. So you know, maybe Islam would say you would do it one way, but because you're from Ethiopia, you would do it a different way because that's more of your cultural background.
Culture is very huge in my family, but I think for us, because when we came to this country, like Samina, we pretty much assimilated. So it was, you know, when my mom first came, she took the veil off and we grew up the same as everyone else. And then for my brothers and sisters, it was, we hit our late teens and we were trying to discover who we were, you know, and at that time, each one of us chose our, it's funny, all of us chose Islam, but we chose it all differently. So some of us veil, some of us don't veil. Some, you know, live a very strict life, and others, I consider myself somewhere in the middle, you know. The veil is the most obvious thing about me, but I think that a lot of it is has to do with people's interpretation because of the media. So one example is after the Boston bombing, I was taking the bus. I wanted to go to San Rafael.
And so this is in Marin.
This is in Marin, yeah. And I asked, you know, the bus driver, I was like, yeah, I want to go to San Rafael. And I paid my money. I got on the bus. And he said, well, get off in Marin City and wait for another bus and it will take you there. And I said to him, I said, but your bus says you go to San Rafael. And he was like, no, you know, just wait for the next bus. And then I sat and waited. It was an odd time of day, so no buses were coming.
So did you have to get off the bus for that?
Yes, I did get off the bus. I'm no Rosa Parks.
So was there anyone else listening to this dialogue, or was it just between you and the driver?
There were people listening. So while I was sitting outside, I sat for a while, and he came back around with a sign saying that he's going to San Rafael. And I got on the bus again. And he was like, you have to get off my bus. And I'm like, why? He said, because there's another bus coming that will take you to San Rafael. And I was like, but your bus goes to San Rafael.
Right, the sign I would paid, be saying San Rafael, right?
I paid you, and I want to go to San Rafael. And he said, no, you have to get off. And there was a crowd of people on the bus at that time. And I just thought that was just so unusual. Wow. But then I was aware of the Boston bombing. I was aware of people's reactions. So I got off. And then I called, you know, Golden Gate Transit and reported it to them. But I got off because it's, you know, I'm, you know, for me, I will fight when a fight is worth it. Mm-hmm. You know, when a cause is worthy. Arguing with a bus driver is not worth it for me, you know. So these the external look does draw, you know.
Yes, and reactions. And maybe we should talk a little bit about this whole sort of post 9/11 experience mm-hmm. of being Muslim, and most recently the Boston bombings, and you know, this maybe what you were talking about, Zahra, with the good Muslims and the bad Muslims, and you know, just the negative perception, so much fear that's out there. Of Muslims, especially after something happens, and you know, and it's interesting that you chose just to get off the bus versus, you know, having that confrontation. And
well, it's not that I'm, you know, weak-willed. I'm a very strong.
Oh, and I
know,
didn't hear it that way, but yeah.
It was that I just, you know, I could see him. He was so upset, and you know what? He felt bad when I got off and sat down. He got off the bus and came to me, and he just, I could see from his expression that he knew he did something wrong.
Struggling.
So that's why I just let it go. I was like, whatever. I put my headphones on and ignored him.
You know? Well, and it sounds like you took a path that made sense for that moment, for sure. So I don't know if anyone wants to weigh in on some other, you know, this whole kind of elephant in the room of the 9/11 and, you know, world we live in.
Well, I was just thinking about what Asya was saying about this incredible story, especially because, you know, so often we think we live in this wonderful bubble that is the Bay Area, where it is so diverse and these things happen still. I think it's funny, if it had been me, of course, that would have been my day's event. And there would have been that conversation. But the one thing that I have the luxury of is that I don't have to, have to is exactly the incorrect verb. I'm not wearing my religion on the outside, mm-hmm. you know? And so I'm not confronted with this on a day-to-day basis like my mother was for so long, you know, where I would see her struggling with it and think, well, why doesn't she argue with that man or that woman? But it's an everyday occurrence. It's a daily event. And like Isa was saying, it's just sometimes not the battle worth fighting. I think after 9/11, those tensions have certainly grown. Mm-hmm. And the fear has grown, and it feels like there's almost a sense that people are justified mm-hmm. in that fear, which is the scariest place for me. That's the area where I live in fear, that people think that this kind of racism or violence or rejection is justified.
And maybe we can all, and I think what's so shocking about that story is the fact it is in the Bay Area. So I want to get it, you know, it was in San Rafael, it was in Marin, you know, we think everyone is so enlightened, but fear is powerful, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think it was racism. It was more prejudice, mm-hmm. you know. So, yeah, I felt more, you know, I felt sorry for the guy more, you know, because he acted and he couldn't take it back, mm-hmm. you know. So the Golden Gate Transit people did call me back and say they were investigating it. And they tried to justify it. I'm like, well, I paid my money. I wanted to get to San Rafael. This man did not want to take me to San Rafael. I don't see anything to investigate. Mm-hmm. You know, it's very clear. So
yeah, and but you know, they would have to have that response probably, so that you know they don't. Who knows what liability or et cetera, they're watching out for. And I'm not making excuses for them, but yeah. I mean, it sounds like there wasn't much to investigate, really.
This isn't the only bus that's done this. It isn't just Golden Gate Transit's kind of infamous for it. They've done it to my mother, who started to veil as well. And it's just something I've seen, you know, often. I'm not bothered by it so much because usually I live in my own headspace, you know, so I'm not really concerned about what other people think. Or, you know, if I did care, then I would look very different, mm-hmm. you know. But, you know, I prefer to be true to myself in that. And it's hopefully by coming here and him hearing this, you know, he'll be like, oh, you know, mm-hmm. and he won't do that
think
again.
Think about, yeah. And I'm curious about, you know, for you, Samin and Zara, you know, we've talked a little bit about the veil and the hijab. And, you know, do you feel pressure ever as Muslim women to veil, or is that something almost like the other side of it? You know, where do you feel that? Is that something you feel? And I'd also love to hear about this sort of whole, we'll talk about this more, but your point of view as feminist and maybe mm-hmm. making a choice that is representing that point of view, too.
I absolutely do not feel pressured to veil. And I think that, like I said earlier, you know, there are many different Muslim communities mm-hmm. in the world where women don't veil. And one of the wonderful things that happened after 9/11 is that there was so much backlash against Muslims that, and so many people saying Muslims are this, Muslims are that, that one of the phenomena that happened is that women across college campuses in the United States started to veil, and there was the veiling movement that was, you know, that began, and that was basically women saying, I am going to be open about my faith. I am going to be in your face mm-hmm. with my faith because you're saying so many things about me. And, you know, and I think that really shows the courage of Muslim women, especially because you read about how that's the unfortunate thing. You know, Muslim men can walk around and they're not always, you can't always identify them. But when a Muslim woman veils, she's such an easy target, you know, whether she's told to get off the bus, whether she's attacked. You know, there was a jogger in Canada who was attacked. There are incidents across the world, especially in France, where women who veil are attacked.
Mm-hmm. And veiling has been banned in some European countries.
Absolutely. Yeah. And in some Muslim countries, wearing the veil has been banned. Mm-hmm. So it goes in both ways. But I think that there is definitely discussions and different thoughts and, you know, different opinions within the Muslim communities about whether a woman should veil or not. But I do think that when it comes to feminism, it's about choice. And that's the bottom line for me. So if I'm choosing to veil because I have personal reasons and I've made that choice, then that's an empowering choice. But if I'm being told to veil, or if I'm being told not to veil, then that takes away my power. And that is a disempowering choice. That's not a choice anymore. So that, to me, is where feminism is. As long as I can express myself with my clothes, with my hair, with my, you know, with whatever I'm doing, if I can express myself freely in the way I choose to, then it's a feminist act.
With that freedom comes the feeling that you are expressing yourself as a feminist. And I'm wondering, Zara, is there anything, you identify yourself as a feminist comedian. Is there anything off limits for you in that? Any pushback from your family about things that, you know, just you feel like I can't go there. I can't. That's a point too far.
I definitely can't borrow my mother's face wash anymore. She's pretty upset about that. I used it all up. You know what's funny, actually? The one thing that I can't do that ironically would give me so much authority is wear the veil on stage.
And say why not?
Well, because I don't.
Because that's a choice you've made.
It would be wrong. It's not what I'm doing, and I would be a charlatan, you know, taking on an identity just to claim an authority. But it is interesting when I am doing a show, whether it's comedy or a solo performance or a panel discussion about being a Muslim woman, if there is a Muslim woman who wears a veil in the audience, everyone listens to what I say and then checks in with her and then decides if they're going to
see if she laughs, like if it's safe to laugh.
If it's safe to laugh, yeah. if she's nodding in agreement, or if she's like, yeah, absolutely. Like, it's sort of the stamp. It's such an irony that it's the stamp of authority. And I can't tell you how many discussions I've been a part of where none of us wear hijab, but the icon connected to the hashtag, connected to the link, is a Muslim woman wearing niqab. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's funny, and that is off limits to me, to do something like that, to take that on, just to pander to the audience's need to fit that avatar. I won't
kind
do
of
that.
Hit that identity stereotype that they want to see.
Yeah, my parents, people always have a question about my parents, are phenomenally supportive of me. Our politics are very much in line. And I think for them, off limits would be for me to be inauthentic to who I am.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like they're great parents.
They are great parents.
Just want to remind everyone that we're listening to City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW, and on the web at KALW.org. And tonight we're talking with three Muslim women artists. We're talking to Zara Norbash, a comedian, writer, and performer whose most recent show was All Atheists Are Muslim. Samina Ali, novelist and curator of the online exhibit Muslima, Muslim Women's Arts and Voices. And Asya Abdraman, a featured artist in the Muslima exhibit. We invite you to call in with your questions or comments. You have questions about what it's like to be a feminist Muslim woman in the Bay Area, or do you want to share your experiences as a Muslim? Our phone number is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or you can email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com or post a comment at KALW.org or on our Facebook page. You know, when I was looking at the Muslima exhibit online, which is fascinating, one of the videos I found on there was really interesting. Was I think it was Canadian. It's two women. It's a little short film that was made. It's two women in a subway, I think it is. And one woman has a full burqa, and all you can see is her eyes. And her eyes are very beautiful. She has eye makeup on. And the other woman comes in, and she almost looks like a streetwalker, sort of a stripper, and she's very scantily clad, and all they do is make eye contact with each other, and one is judging the other and then judging back, and I thought it was so fascinating. And then there's a sort of interplay with a stander by who, you know, starts having all these crazy, you know, thoughts in his head, but that wasn't actually as interesting to me as the, with no words at all, how much you could understand or sort of see what's going on between these two women. And they both clearly seem to feel that they were expressing themselves as strong women. That's what I got, is, you know, I'm, you know, you can't judge me. I'm being who I am. And the other person saying the sort of same thing. And, you know, we've been talking a lot about the diversity of Muslim women voices. And I don't know if any of you can, you know, if that feels familiar to you, to sort of kind of join in the sisterhood of Muslim women. They weren't quite as sisters by the end of the film, but, you know, just sort of acknowledge that there's all these different ways to express yourselves as feminist Muslim women. Or do you feel sometimes you have to draw a line in the sand, like, this is how I'm going to do it, and I have to make a stand, and it's very different from you, and we're different. Does anyone have an experience in that regard that you could share?
Actually, I do. It's interesting. Like I said, within my family, there's different extremes of covering, all the way to face covering, to completely scantily clad. And I don't think I would ever have that experience of looking at another and judging, because I know myself, and I know that, you know, the appearance that I give leads a lot of people to think I don't speak English, or, you know, and, you know, governments like France or Turkey that ban, you know, wearing the veil, it handicaps the women that do wear the veil, because they prevent them from going to work or going to universities and things like that. So my veil is, you know, it's partially spiritual, partially defiance. You know, when my dad saw me, I hadn't seen him in many years, and he saw me with a veil, he was like, "Why are you wearing that? Take it off."
Sort of the opposite.
You know, You know, because he raised us to be completely assimilated, and he saw putting the veil on was part of, you know, separating ourselves from society. But I feel that I'm fully, you know, I'm fully completely blended into the society that I live in. I know Muslims and I know non-Muslims, and I just am myself, you know. So the feminist side of me comes in when people, you know, translate the Quran poorly, and then they say, you know, the men are going to get virgins in heaven, you know, but the word is azwaj, and azwaj means spouse, you know, and spouse is neutral. It could be male or female, right? So, you know, those are the times where the feminist in me rises, because it's like, I actually wrote to a place that had it mistranslated. And this is the first time I did it. I wrote to them. I said, you know, that word, the translation is this. People that speak English, you know, they're going to think the religion is only for men, you know. And the writer must be some misogynist, but you need to change this and if you don't change it, you're going to alienate a whole group of English-speaking Muslims that cannot read Arabic and know that that word is gender neutral.
And it's interesting because you hear that repeated so many times. So clearly that misunderstanding has been perpetuated, whether it's a convenience by the media or... I'm going to just take a moment. We've gotten a couple of emails here. I have a question from Jim in San Jose. How do you make sense of some of the rights women have here in the U.S. and how some of those rights are more constrained in other parts of the Muslim world, such as driving, voting, and education? Do you see the rights women have in the United States as universal? And should Westerners help that change occur and give women in other parts of the world the kinds of freedoms that Muslim women have here?
Well, in Arizona, people of color can't drive without being stopped for papers. In Texas, women don't have rights. And in Florida, better get out of there now. So I think we need to set up an asylum first for people fleeing to the Bay Area from Texas, Florida, and Arizona. And after that happens, if we decide to go to war for feminism, I will suit up.
So you're willing to join the army. For that.
I will suit up. Let's go. It'll probably mess me up, but I'm on board.
It's one of the unfortunate things that people consistently point to women not being able to drive in Saudi as, you know, as an example of how women, Muslim women, don't have any rights and they're denied these rights. But it's, if you look at it, you know, including the examples that Zahra raises right here in the U.S., a lot of these rights that are taken away from women, they have nothing to do with faith. They have nothing. It has to do with power. It has to do with politics. And it has to do with patriarchy. You know, and those are the three. And it's the same even in Saudi. It's absolutely not part of the religion that women shouldn't be able to drive. It's absolutely not part of the religion. What Asiya said earlier about female genital mutilation, that is not part of the faith in any way. It's completely cultural. And so there are a lot of these things that happen within each different country where they're imposing their own laws that don't really have to do with the faith.
And here's what bothers me the most about it is that what is the conclusion that we're drawing if it is true? Because it is true in many places where religion is used. I mean, Texas is a great example. Iran is a great example mm-hmm. where religion is used as a way of imposing sexism, chauvinism, patriarchy. And it's not right. But what is the conclusion that we draw from that? What does that mean?
So it means therefore, that women have to start getting more power, start interpreting the religion themselves, start taking back. You see the unfortunate reversal of fortune in, you know, the Middle East. We had the Arab uprisings. Women were so part of that and they helped with that. And now, unfortunately, they're being told to step back. Thanks for your help. Mm-hmm. But now we're going to have our own little all-male government.
And separately, here in the United States, when we make these arguments, I'm just wondering then, for those people who say that, you know, what is the outcome then? Does that mean that therefore our manifest destiny is justified? You know, if we really are going in with the intention of goodwill and prosperity, it doesn't look that way right now.
Mm-hmm. Right. Is there just one more excuse for going into another country and, you know?
Well, I think, you know, when he said, you know, women there versus women here, I think women everywhere should take responsibility for themselves. You know, my mom took responsibility for us and decided our future. Women in Saudi Arabia should be supported, but they should change their circumstances on their own. Women everywhere, they don't need a hero to save them. They can save themselves.
And was a woman in Saudi Arabia recently who went driving and just sort of did her own one person. Or I don't know if she was supported as part of a larger movement, but I know she became a focal point.
Well, there is a movement happening globally within the Muslim women's organizations, such as Musawa in Malaysia, which is headed by Zaina Anwar, who did Sisters in Islam for 30 years. There are other organizations, whether it's in Africa or different parts of the Middle East, where women are leading. They are the leaders of reform. And they're saying, you know what, we're going to change what's happening within our communities, we're going to change what's happening within our countries, but we're going to do it ourselves. Even in Iran, especially in Iran, there are a lot of women there who are taking charge and saying, we're going to start interpreting the texts, we're taking it back from these very, you know, we're going to stop giving the power away to the men. We are going to educate the younger generation of women, according, you know, let them know what their rights are. And then we're going to start creating a system where we can actually make change happen. And they're doing it within the context of Islam. That's the most important point. They're very wary of getting, you know, what they think of as being contaminated by American feminism, these sorts of things. So they would like to do it within.
And is there institutional support for that within the Muslim religion? I mean, are there going to be clerics who will come out in support of that? I mean, it's, I would imagine, very difficult for women. You can say stand up and you can say, you know, take action. But in a patriarchal society where your rights are somewhat constrained, it's going to be difficult.
Absolutely. I have an interview in the exhibition with Dr. Shireen Ebadi, who's the first Muslim woman to ever receive the Nobel Peace Prize. And she not only has had death threats, she's not only been thrown in jail. She's from Iran. But she even had the government confiscate her Nobel Prize medal. Mm. So it's an uphill battle. And, you know, and a lot of the women reformers who I've interviewed across the globe who are leading change, they are coming up against death threats. They're coming up against. But I think that pushback happens no matter. I mean, think even in terms of this country and what the women's suffrage and the kind of work that women had to do, all of the things that we now take for granted. I mean, women sacrificed so much when they were first beginning these movements. And I think that when we look at many of these other organizations in these other parts of the world, they're just at the beginning. So if we have to place it into context of where we were.
Mm-hmm. That there's a that you can't put it in the same almost timeline.
You can't.
I know that. Asya, did you have your hand up a minute ago?
I did. When it comes to feminism and women in other parts of the world, I think culture, although it's beautiful in some cases, the things that are wrong within culture, you know, women should be, you know, aware of that and choose to not follow the culture when it comes to things like the female genital mutilation. You know, no one likes something. If you don't like something to happen to you, how can you, you know, constantly see it happen again and again and again? I was going to say there's a story of, you know, my sister. She was in a very abusive relationship. And I told her, I said, you know, why don't you learn a little bit about your religion? You know, because this isn't right. And so she started to study. And when she started to study, she started to study under Hamza Yusuf, which is a Bay Area scholar. Her husband forbade her from going because she told him, hey, this is wrong. What you're doing is not right.
And she said, was able to say it doesn't fit. Was he justifying it?
Yeah, because he tried to say, well, this is Islam, mm-hmm. you know. And it was not Islam. When she went and studied, she found out that had nothing to do with Islam. And he told her, you know, if you go out and learn again, and we're going to have problems. They're not married anymore, but things like that, it's, you know, you need to, that thing of knowledge being power, mm-hmm. it should be the responsibility of every woman to seek it out. You know, now you have YouTube, you have so many ways to learn. You can't make excuses of saying, well, I didn't know.
And it sounds like kind of what you're saying, coming at it from within the faith.
Absolutely.
So I want to talk in our last few minutes here about the role of art in helping to open up some of these dialogues. But I got a request, Sarah. This is one for you. You've said to us that feminism and Muslim and, you know, a lot of the things that you identify yourself as a comedian don't go together. So I have a question. Can you please tell a Muslim joke?
Tell a Muslim joke? That's its own joke. I don't give away jokes for free.
Uh-oh.
I am a paid comedian. But if you would like
maybe
to
you tell
me
a funny story, I don't know. He's challenging.
Certainly, I can certainly do that. Oh, is that what it is?
I'm kind of hearing it as a challenge.
It's a challenge. I missed it. What a punk. you can come to the Great American Music Hall where I'll be performing with Eloisa Brava and Kimberly Brent as part of a showcase. I'll be headlining on August 24th, the Great American Music Hall in San Francisco, and we'll have it out then.
All right. That sounds like the throwdown.
I think so.
Okay. but maybe more broadly, you could just talk. You've touched on this, but I think what's really interesting in looking at Muslima, and I know you're involved in that too, Asya, is, you know, opening up some of these dialogues through art. Mm-hmm. And as I mentioned, you know, I think we can all read something and that's interesting. But watching this video, for example, I found very arresting. And actually, my 11-year-old daughter was sitting with me, too. And we were both so fascinated by how this filmmaker portrayed this very interesting dynamic. So, you know, I don't know if there's a particular story you could tell or just maybe your perspective on the role art has played for each one of you in helping you find that voice.
Yeah, absolutely. I think a lot of, I mean, I spoke in the beginning about how crucial art was to me and how I sort of found my identity and thereby my voice. I have a lot of fun on stage, of course, with stereotypes in comedy. You have setup, punchline, you have tension build, and then you sort of burst that bubble and release that tension. And so it's a lot of fun to play with stereotypes, you know, to take something that is a stereotype and flip it on its head and make jokes about it, you know. And it's very empowering that way. It's also a great tool where, you know, some things I don't explain for. You know, for instance, I'm not going to prove that I have a sense of humor. That's ridiculous. And when my audience, you know, comes in, they come in with some expectations, and there are some that I don't serve.
And that feels powerful for you, just to say,
yeah,
you know.
It feels powerful. It also feels like its own statement.
Yes. And that comes back to maybe what you're saying, not pandering. I'm not going to wear a veil. I'm not going to inhabit all these stereotypes that you expect me to have.
Right. So buy a ticket and you will see that I am funny.
We know you're funny.
Oh, and it's Kimberly Wendt. I completely messed up the last name of my co-performer.
Samina or Asya, would you, either one of you, like to go next?
You know, I came, you know, my first career, I guess, was as a fiction writer and a novelist. And so I've come at these issues from the creative side consistently. And what I love is that, you know, when you are in a position where you have to go and see a lecture or you're about to see a debate, I think that people tend to come in with their own minds already made up. They already have their opinions, and it's very rare that you can really go in and change somebody's mind. But with art, what I love about it, the beauty of art, the beauty of writing, the beauty of the film that you watched in the Muslima exhibition is that you don't come in with, you know, all boxed up and, you know, with your ideas formed. You don't have your arms crossed over yourself. You come very open, relaxed. And that's really the state you need to be in to create the understanding and to create empathy. And so I love that you saw that video, and I love that you were able to empathize and really able mm-hmm. to see what she was trying to get across. And, you know, and most of the time that's what happens. You know, when I'm writing my novel or what, you know, I'm not consistently saying, I'm a Muslim woman. Mm-hmm. You know, you're writing and you're relating to people. And that's the bottom line with art.
And through story, and it's yes. so powerful. Can we close with you, Asya?
Yes. I actually had no awareness that my artwork was spiritual or that it even had anything to do with my Islam. But in this year, and being a part of this exhibit, and a lot of my paintings have veils in them, and the veil as a thing of empowerment, not a thing of oppression, whether you choose not to wear it or choose to. For me, it has a beautiful history, you know. It's a shelter. And so coming off of this, I'm even moving on to projects where I'm creating, you know, from that veil, food and shelter, mm-hmm. you know. So instead of that symbol of the woman being repressed, it becomes the rescue system.
And so you find yourself naturally expressing that.
I do. It comes, I guess, because I love my grandmother and I love my mother, and my grandmother wears a veil that goes all the way to the ground, you know. And when I was younger, I saw someone in a refugee camp, a woman, that she had a large veil that she made into her tent, her house, and she would go inside of it, and all her children would be inside, and she would be naked in there. She wouldn't be able to come out because that was her house for that moment. And then when the daytime would come, her kids would all run out of the tent, and then she'd put it on. You know, so
I love that. Let's all close with that very amazing image. I really want to thank all of you for being our guests tonight. We had Zahra Norbash, a comedian, writer, and performer, whose most recent show was called All Atheists Are Muslim. It has a new show coming up at the Great American Music Hall we heard about. Samina Ali, who's a novelist and curator of the online exhibit Muslima, Muslim Women's Arts and Voices. As I mentioned, a link to that show is on our website. And Asya Abdraman, a featured artist in the Muslima exhibit. I want to thank you all for joining me. And for a link to this and other City Vision show, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program and to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Vision's page on klw.org. Our engineer this evening was Bob Summer. Tonight's show was produced by Wendy Holcomb. Great job, Wendy. Our in-studio producer is Susie Britton. Thank you, Susie. Next week, let's join our regular host, Joseph Pache, for a one-on-one conversation with San Francisco public defender Jeff Adachi. This is guest host Victoria Thorpe. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week.